All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.
Welcome to a live version of John Bowd's All the Rage. We do a mixture of live and John gets out and about when he can. Obviously, it's been difficult, but he has been maintaining a really good series of interviews via Zoom. He's having a I think if it was a boxing match between John and his microphone, I think the microphone's on points. It's winning on points. We're coming up to the 12th round, John. John?
Microphone is properly whipping my arse. There's no two ways about it. It is early years Mike Tyson, this microphone, I'm telling you. Just the speed and agility with which it is slapping me. I keep listening to these. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts, as I've probably told you before, and they're just wonderful. I think the word is synonymous. Sounds of people's microphones, just like, yeah, I want that. Why can't I do that with my system? Well, what can I say? Still, credit to anyone who sticks with us. No, I do appreciate it. It's a very uphill struggle, along with the just staggeringly awful heat right now. This thing here is telling me it's 29 degrees in this room. It's 7 o'clock on a Wednesday night somewhere in England, and it's 29 degrees. I'm not... Do we have early feedback on that one, or should we just get on with the real part of the show? No, let's go. Okay. Well, what should we talk about this week? Well, I suppose just a kind of general British failure special is the words I wrote at the top of this show. Nothing changes with the words I wrote. Okay, so why am I saying that? Let's get into it. So let's begin this week with discussing the recent European football tournament. Yes, we're going to talk about football again. Or more importantly, we're going to talk about its ending. And it ended, of course, with the two countries, England and Italy, in the final. The match went to penalties, as they often do, and so naturally England lost. But what then caught everyone's attention was the abuse that followed. The abuse was specifically racial, and it was related to penalties taken by black players. Not so much racial abuse based on anything taken by white players. But there you are. What, for me, all of this really revealed, and why I want to talk about it, was a delusion that we have in Britain, that we've told ourselves how much better a place this country is, and particularly the claim that football has got much less racist and much more accepting. There's a bit of a pattern here, you know, these things happen and the abuse always goes to one thing about a couple of specific players, and it's always a race thing, but we still like to tell ourselves, oh, you know, football's not as bad as it used to be, they don't throw bananas anymore, or they don't do it. And then, of course, you go to a game and certain fans start doing monkey noises and stuff like that. So really, it's all total lies and fantasy. When the hardcore England fans, whatever you want to call them, crawl out, they are still the same drunken extremists that span across all age groups who can only express their love of the game and country with threats, abuse, and getting drunk beyond function. The government could not bring themselves to face this contingent when they booed the knee-taking because they knew that this lot are part of their voting base. They are also, the government, also racists and haters of the working class too, so any division within this is only to their benefit. The right had a problem with this from the off because they wanted to blame woke politics and actions for England's loss in the tournament, but then the team went and got to the final. The dickless hit pieces had no doubt been written by most of the commentators, but they had to pop them in the bottom drawer until the next failure in the early rounds of something, and then they can whip them out and start all over again. Some still managed to take a few hits, criticising Marcus Rashford for his exemplary work helping to prevent the Conservative government from cutting free school dinners for the poorest children, and time again that he's been doing that. Some suggested that taking the knee was no way to win, yet it did not stop Italy from doing just that because they took the knee and they won the final. None of these criticisms hold up, nor are any of them made in anything close to good faith. This is just the same repulsive churn of racism and intolerance and hatred of anything progressive going over and over again. But on this, I'm also going to criticise the liberal-minded folk out there with their ideas of progressive patriotism who think this was ever in any kind of a real possibility. Wherever you raise that flag, especially when the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary openly support booing anti-racism gestures on the pitch, you will only ever attract the racists. They are sitting in their provinces high on bucolic fantasy and cocaine, fed by Brexit and waiting for the call-up. The racism is always there, so anyone trying to say that actions of BLM are too extreme or saying that existing football anti-racism initiatives are better is clearly stupid or lying to hide their real agenda, maintaining the racist status quo and keeping non-white people in society into inferior positions. No matter what your achievements, how well you behave or represent the country even, they will never accept you. A conservative mindset, a rich mindset, cannot allow those who for centuries have been lesser to them to finally gain some power over their own lives, and God forbid they retain or attain any level of equality. But I also must highlight a few important aspects not talked about much in the media and the wider discourse, and that is the majority of the fans in the streets that day. So I was actually in London on the 11th of July, which was the day of the final that was being played at the kind of world-famous Wembley Stadium. From at least lunchtime, Leicester Square was full of drunken louts, breaking things, letting off smoke grenades and intimidating people, as much video footage online will show you. There's some footage of them attacking the... I still think it's a Burger King. You know, Leicester Square is one of those places I've walked through so many times in over the years that I actually can't remember exactly which shops and restaurants are where. They all kind of meld into one. They still look like 1996 to me. But, yeah, I believe it's the Burger King that goes out. For some reason, they were smashing that up from the outside, even though there were other people inside with their little cape flags on, so I don't know what that was about. As I say, they were messing with people, intimidating them, gathering together, no social distance, no masks, not a single mask. Almost every one of them had a flag and none of them had a mask. That was on the train on the way up there. That was when I was in London. That was when I finished what I was doing up there and I was going home, passing Wembley, just all piled in like sardines, none of them taking any precautions. Yesterday, there were, and I'm not going to make casual links, science is smarter than that, but just to give you an idea of where we are in Britain right now, the death toll from COVID-related illness yesterday was 1986 people. So it's gone way back up. Anyway, the trains were rammed full of them. As I said, they were out yelling and acting like demented children. Multiple fights were recorded while the police stood back and did their usual nothing. If they'd been non-white or anti-capitalist protesters, these uniformed thugs would have been well in there without a single pause. This group of true fans, of true patriots, expressed their love of team and of country by coming to the capital city, smashing things up and leaving literal rivers of piss in the streets around them. They were aggressive, intolerant and overwhelmingly white. This is still the face of English football, whether you like it or not. Now, there's a couple of other things I want to look at before I jump in. Actually, no, I'll tell you what, Dave, do you want to, let's cut this up a little bit differently. Do you want to jump back in and talk about the football?
Well, it was really good, and I did put a post up of Jonathan Pye, a parody news presenter. He presents something in a very liberal BBC-type thing, and off-camera he'll give his honest view. And the bottom line of what he said about the behaviour of the England fans was, we won't get anywhere, we won't be invited anywhere, and we won't win anything because you can't bloody behave yourself. If you think, I think he one of the comments he made was, if you think that good behaviour is being sick outside on the JD Sports window, think again. It was brilliant, actually, and it got maximum coverage. It was a brilliant piece by Jonathan Pye. John?
Yeah, we're actually saying that, how bizarre to kind of switcheroo my loyalties there, because if you're doing anything negative towards JD Sports or Sports Direct or those other horrendous workers' rights abusers, actually, I don't really have a problem with that. It's, if you're going to puke on something, it might as well be them. But yeah, no, I quite agree. And the heart of what I'm really trying to get to here, Dave, one of the main reasons I bring this up, is I'm just so pissed off with people going on about how society's improved and football's improved. What happened? You know, when it comes down to what happened, we had a football tournament, the England team doing a stellar job this year of ignoring the media, of ignoring antagonistic racists within the fans, within their audience, ignoring the government, or actually taking on the government directly, straight after the game, challenging the Home Secretary and the Prime Minister, who were then going, giving it all the come on England stuff, and say, hang on a minute, 2-3 weeks ago, you were praising people or telling people it was fine to boo us, and now we've got to this point. And, you know, what happens? They lose on penalties because they're England, and England always lose on penalties. And what happens? The racial abuse just goes hyper. Just all over again, like nothing had ever changed. Because it hasn't changed.
Well, just on a member of an ethnic minority, and I know in Wembley, I suppose these knew or know Sterling's mum, because she lives in the postal area. And one of the things she said to us when Raheem decided to play for England, she wasn't worried that he'd fail or he'd hurt himself. One of the things she said to us was she fears that if he fails on the field with England, she and her family and her son will be abused racially. This is before her, you know, he's even kicked the ball for England. And all ethnic minority parents whose sons or daughters play for the England football team do fear that. They knew, those lads knew when they missed. They knew when they walked back to their pals that they were going to be racially abused after the game, or during the game, but certainly after the misses and the penalty. And just for those who wish to ridicule the England football team, yes, they lost on penalties. This is the second semi-final. This is the first final for as many years. And they were only in the semi-finals with young lads. And so, obviously, it's one of the best England teams, isn't it? But if you look at the stats, semi-final of the World Cup, final of the Euro. Oh, isn't that the Euro that we wanted to come out of? Anyway, so, you know, it doesn't... Before we slag people off, they got us far with an average age of 20. Unbelievable. And Gareth Southgate has done a fantastic job. And not just that, he did a wonderful piece by Gareth Southgate on their responsibility socially. And it's something that Graham Taylor and Bobby Robson couldn't do, probably wanted to say it, but he did it. And he did it with the lads with style. So, back off. It's not the 80s. That's gone. It's not coming back. And I'll just say this, in Harrow, the pub's in Harrow, John, and I'm hoping, it's not my son. My son went with a few mates who wanted to sing It's Coming Home. It's not, the song's not called It's Coming Home, by the way. It's called Three Lions. And they decided, not my son, to sing Three Lions. And all the pubs where they went to, they were told by the owners, no, we don't allow that to be sung. You know, people are trying to watch the TV, you know, stop making noise, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And I'm not advocating, you know, quelling people's excitement, because you should be excited, you know, a group of young lads representing our community, for sure, my community, where I grew up in, at the world stage. That's a good thing. And playing good football. But, I think we're not there yet, but it's happening. Because certainly in Harrow, they weren't allowing that song. If I hear it again...
To be honest, if that would be my pub if I run that. I'd just be like, no singing, especially that sodding song.
Well, they did. To be fair, they did. And my son came back. He wasn't upset. He just said, Dad, they, my friends were trying to sing that song. And they said, look, if you're going to be loud, move on. And I'm hoping that... But, yeah, you mentioned Leicester Square. Pac-Man, who's a presenter on Trax FM... he was passing through Wembley because he shopped in Harlesden, and he passed there Monday morning, and he said it was a sea of just junk. He couldn't believe it. And we grew up in Harlesden, me and Pac-Man, and we've seen a lot of things, but he was lost for words of the state of Wembley. John?
Yeah, I mean, the Scotland fans came down to play their games in the early rounds, and they took their rubbish with them. I mean, how hard is it? I just honestly mean this now. It's just, you talk about love of country, you talk about this, and, you know, a sports game, I don't really give a shit what sport it is. Okay, football's got some great connection to violence and weirdly associated to the war for some reason too. But this is the one they all crawl out for. They don't do it for cricket, they don't do it for darts, you know, they do it for the football. And what do? You smash the place up. You literally, there were literal rivers of piss in your capital city. Is that how you love your country? That's a serious question. Okay, I want to, if the people out there who did that, I want to know, what is this form of expressing yourself like an absolute beast? Is it something I don't get? And more importantly, you know, why do you talk about, because many of you do, let's be honest, talk about other races in terms of them being kind of savage in some way, or you know, the English are the real savages, we always were. I just don't get it. I just think it's very bizarre and very twisted. Look, I'm not going to fill up the show with waffling on about my great hatred of sports and my great hatred of big events that distract people from what's really going on. However, I am going to give you a handful of examples of, you know, this wonderful country, what a wonderful place it is to live right now, and how your decent patriotic care and duty and love for your fellow countrymen is being expressed right now. So let's talk about the children of key workers who are in poverty. Now, many of you, wherever you are in the world, no doubt remember that as the COVID-19 disaster kicked into gear, many political leaders and the professional managerial class creatures suddenly found a new love for the people who do all of the real work in society. Caregivers, health workers, council employees, refuse workers, cleaners especially, supermarket employees, even us lovely postmen and women, we got some love, at least verbally. We were suddenly recognised as this great thing called key workers, and government ministers could make speeches praising us while passing legislation to make those in the NHS even poorer while doing their vital jobs. Well, one result of all of this meaningless clapping on doorsteps with no political change attached to it is that we are now seeing an increase in poverty, specifically affecting children of said key workers. The TUC has done a search which has found more than a million children, in their words, from the households of frontline workers in the COVID-19 pandemic are presently living in poverty. The report was prepared for the TUC by Landman Economics Consultancy using the government definition of key workers. So the study found, among other things, 1 in 5 children of key workers in England, Scotland and Wales were living below the official breadline, rising to almost 1 in 3 in the North East. This is the worst affected region, of course, too. It found 29% of the children of key workers' households in the North East were living in poverty, followed by London, 27%, West Midlands, 25%, and Yorkshire and the Humber, also at 25%. The lowest rates were in the east of England at 15.5% and southwest at 15.6%. The TUC said low pay and insecure hours, widespread in occupations like social care, supermarket workers and delivery driving, were the main reasons for in-work poverty amongst key workers. A clear sign, in my view, that hard work does not pay. The TUC General Secretary, Francis O'Grady, said that the Prime Minister should put workers and their families like this at the centre of his supposed Build Back Fairer plans, whatever they are, that are supposed to be the crux of what they're planning to do coming out of the COVID lockdown and downturn. Francis points out that we need to fight for them and that it also makes sense to give money to these families and put it in their pockets, because it benefits the entire economy. I quite agree. The TUC noted that not only are pay and hours directly responsible for this situation, but also high housing costs were reducing the amount of money key workers' households could spend on food, living stuffs and utilities. Universal credit is failing to prevent the slide into poverty or further into it, as usually the case. And that's actually going to be due to have a £20 cut per week come in the autumn. The current government policies, according to this report, were likely to increase poverty rates, end of quote, because along with cutting universal credit, ministers have capped pay rises for key workers in the public sector, leading in some cases to cuts in wages when adjusted for inflation. The TUC says that these policies will negatively affect the recovery in Britain. They put it as curbs on household spending would restrain business activity and have knock-on effects on wage growth for other workers. Now, yeah, I mean, there's a few things to say with that one. I'm going to give you 2 or 3 of these examples of what's going on at the moment. Yeah, I mean, I've always said to people, I'm not particularly good at maths, but I can count. That comes to money and it comes to votes. And I think this is a very good example of that sort of thing. Yeah, Dave, do you want to feedback on this one before we move on to the next one?
Yeah, there's a funny thing going on in the workplaces at the moment, in that it's a traditional generational aging workforce, and it's replaced very slowly by a new workforce, especially in government agencies like Royal Mail, the DWP, the NHS, and we, you know, it's a generational thing. It's 20, maybe 25 year gap in between these things that happen in the workplace. That's if the workplace is there, because technology and all that stuff. But what's happening since last March, it's accelerated. People have just, it's mental health, stress, the workplace. A lot of our aging workforce don't believe in the COVID virus until they get it. They're singled out by their colleagues who do believe in the vaccine, who do believe in the face masks. Trade union reps are also under stress because the government got guidance is woolly at best, and the employer just deviates, but doesn't deviate from government guidance. So the stress goes right through. So because of what's happening out there at the moment, people are just leaving. The aging workforce have just left before their time. And the workforce is being recruited, mass recruited, to government agencies like the DWP and the NHS. The paramedic people are calling out for jobs at the moment. There's a massive shortage of truck drivers at the moment, because the truck drivers are used to come here to work from the EU, and they're not here anymore. And they're offering some serious wages for people to drive trucks at the moment. So if you look at your supermarkets at the moment, you'll see some of the shelves are starting to get empty. That's not because of COVID, okay? There's a shortage of truck drivers. A workforce that used to come from Europe to cover that work can't come over anymore, and there's just not people here want the job. And so the younger workforce are having to do the jobs of our members 10 years before it should happen. It's just that accelerated. And you've got to remember, our ageing workforce, they're not so computer-centric, which is pretty much half of the UK, if not more. Remember, a lot of factories and stuff have closed, as you know, in the 70s and 80s. You could leave school on a Friday and get a job Monday because you had a factory near you. That's all gone. So, yeah, things are changing. It's really accelerated. What we do ask is that the administration, the current administration, rather than take advantage of that, try and actually guide people through this, because we're all going through unprecedented times. Don't take the mickey out of it. Don't capitalise on it. You know, help these kids come through, you know, because if you don't, there's going to be a huge gap, a job gap as such. And the work that we would traditionally do, no one wants to do it. So we need to, rather than starve them to work, and you'll end up with a really horrible generation of people who just hate you and hate everything, let's try and encourage them, give them incentives to actually pick up this work, because the work's there, you know. And as a trade unionist, we want that work. We want people to have jobs. We want people to have meaningful employment. We want the jobs that we're doing now, that it gave us things, we want it for those younger people. But don't punish people for it. John?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I'm sorry to say, I think it's just part of their nature. I think it's a part of the nature of conservatives. It's part of the nature of neoliberalism. It's about punishing working people because they look down on us. It's as simple as that. They're happy when, as I say earlier on with all the football thing we were talking about, they're happy with being divisive towards us. It benefits them. You know, look at all of the evil shit that the Home Secretary's got away with in the last couple of weeks. Look at the votes that have gone through, because we're all busy talking about that. Because you're all busy getting distracted by whether or not someone takes a knee or not.
Well, look, I'm not going to talk about either sides of the aisle or whatever. I know when my bread is buttered or was buttered. But I'll tell you this, right, for our ageing listeners or ageing workforce, I'll tell you this, in regards to the SDP who broke up from the Labour Party in 1981, created big news then. Didn't do anything as a party, but if you look at the time, those five members, right? Shirley Williams, Dr. David Owen, David Steele, for example, Roy Jenkins, right? That any one of those four, right, could have been Prime Minister. I mean, good Prime Minister. I mean, experience, poise, you know, the ability to negotiate diplomatically, internationally, big business, small business, social issues. If they stood up in front of the telly, you'd say, wow, that is a politician. They were that good at that era, those politicians. And then I go to Blair. I know, don't spit when I say it, you go to Blair, who, and Gordon Brown, for example, although they kept a monopoly on their party, but you, there's a style about them. I'm not going to go into their policies. I'm just saying there's a style about them. There was a style about them. They were very diplomatic on things that they were asked on the TV, like Glenn Hoddle saying something about disabled people. What do you think about that? Live on telly. They were very dignified. They were very politically correct. They were did the right thing as leaders should. And I'm sorry to say, the calibre of those politicians, good, bad, or indifferent, and today, it comes up well short. I mean, it just comes up well short. And it's no wonder that no one knows what to do in regards to the general public and this awful pandemic. It's no wonder that no one knows what to do.
Mm. You know? Yeah, there's a complete, not even just a lack. That makes it sound as if there is some, but there's not enough. There's just a complete absence.
Yeah, I just couldn't imagine a text saying that one member of his cabinet is totally effing useless. I just can't imagine, i.e. the four members of the Social Democratic Party from 1981 who split. I can't imagine them writing a letter and letting that leak out. You know, it just wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't happen.
I think they might have said some rather unpleasant things about Tony Benn in private, but yeah, I know what you mean.
But even their debates were professional, you know. Whoever's in power, I'm not going to go on about it, I'm just saying that they won't even have a debate. They won't even have a live debate and talk to people and see what their issues are. They won't do it, and that's the mistake.
That's because one of the other things specifically about the kind of leadership we've got at the moment, especially Johnston, our friend Priti Patel, Gove, any of those people. It's funny, isn't it? Because one of the things that their kind of class of people really prize is this great ability to debate, to be kind of pretty and flowery with your language and put points across. They all can't debate for shit. Boris Johnson is so... he is such a... I know, yeah, he's a politician, yeah, he's a prime minister, obviously he's a liar, whatever. The guy is such a liar that if he's ever put on the spot, he will just immediately, like a kid that's been caught stealing sweets, he will just immediately go, no, it wasn't me. No, I didn't do it. You saw it, you know, during the election campaign when someone was giving him shit in the hospital saying, you're only here for a media, for a media buzz, just to look good in the press. No, I'm not. There's no media here. Who's that camera over there? Who's the reason why we, the public, are seeing this event? There's a camera over there. Oh, that one. Okay. I mean, it's almost comical. Do you know what? I think what's telling right now is I think you would struggle at the moment, and I'm sure the inventors of Spit and Image will tell you this, I think you'd struggle to actually make anything satirical about the present leadership we've got at the moment, because they seem like a really, really bad joke for a really second-rate film about how crap politics is. That's really telling.
It's interesting because one of the things was, certainly when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, the power of the written media, the red tops, and always a cabinet member a cabinet member's leaked something to the hard press, the hard printed media. Do you know what? That's gone now. There's no leaks to the hard press media because they don't have the influence anymore. What people are doing now, if they're going to leak stuff, they just go on Twitter, and it goes wildfire, and it actually gets to people better than the written media, which is dying on its knees, like GB News. I just had to get that one in there. Sorry, John.
That's fine with me. Any chance to smash GB as you go right ahead?
Well, I've just heard they recruited someone else, gave them meaningful employment. That's good. Because he was unemployed.
He was. You're quite right. He was very unemployed.
And his mate's not in power anymore. So, anyway.
He wants to learn to drive a truck, though.
Yeah, the most unqualified MP ever. But someone gave him a job.
Not an MP. Never an MP.
I've never seen a rat jump on a sinking ship. That's really bizarre.
But this is what happens when you get too fucking cocky, though. Do you know what I mean? When you think you're great.
If I was an investor and they said we're starting a station and we're going to talk about everything, you know, blah blah blah, whatever it is, I'd say no. That you're dying, mate. You're going. You're gone by 2030. I don't even think the party you're representing will be relevant. Anyway,
no, your people are done.
Yeah. But yeah, they're not leaking stuff to the press anymore, because normally with Blair you'd have advisors, and he had Campbell there, and he was making sure what was leaked to the press what wasn't, because they were relevant then. But if you speak to Gordon Brown now, he'll say to you, we're not relevant now.
He's right. At least he's honest. He's a lot more honest than these leftover fucking Blairites to keep coming out to slag off Corbyn. Who are you?
The most liberal Labour version is Gordon Brown, and he said, look, we're not relevant anymore, we just don't exist anymore, because you've got social media, you don't need the press anymore, you wouldn't need a press advisor anymore, you just need someone ahead of social media, and even then things go wildfire, you've got no control of it whatsoever. The minute you say anything, that's so what the right wing media do now, because the more left-wing members of the public, who far exceed, don't let people tell you that they're a minority, they are a majority. How the right-wing media or the right-wing press or the right-wing commentators get attention is they'll say something very antisocial. They probably don't mean it, because they will get from the left side of the general public, they will get so much interaction on what that one tweet is, and it will be vociferous and there'll be name calling and all that stuff, because the more left side of the country have a lot to say and say it and call you out on it. You think that GB News, we know it's crap, but people were watching it just to take the mickey out of it. And the only people interacting with it is just to take the mickey out of it.
So people putting forward fake names to see if they got run out.
It was so funny. It was so funny. And I knew that. And I would say to people, look, don't put their name on. Don't put it. They go, no, we want to. They're just so funny. And that's the only interaction they had.
Again, like, I know it's just a laugh, but in all honesty, seriously, if your level of broadcast experience is that you will read out either Biggin or, I need a piss on the air, I mean, come on. We used to do that shit to radio, calling radio stations when I was about 12.
Yeah, that is bad.
Chris Tarrant's better than you people, they would have spotted it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like getting your granddad to control a computer, you know. Here's Ivor Biggin, he's got something. And you say, granddad, don't, that's not real. Press that button there. Don't do that. And who would invest in something that's going? A part of the country, as I said, I spoke about generational things that are happening. I'd say 25 every 30 years. It's going to happen every 10 years. 2030, politically, socially, this country is going to be totally different. Guaranteed, John.
Yes. Shout out to Ivor Longdong and and Fatima Large Muff. Yeah, let's not get that. By the way, just one other thing I want to say before we carry on is I just thought a minute ago when you said something about it's not the 80s anymore, I thought if this show had an alternative title and it fitted on the marquee, I think It's Not the 80s Anymore would probably be the best title for the show. We're now at episode 161. In the time that we've been doing this, if there's something that has come up so often to me, it's so much of what we're talking about, so much of the damage of what's happened to our world now comes from the sodding 80s.
The 80s, socially, I meant, there's nothing wrong with 80s music, and if you're not careful, I'm going to play something 90s like Wigfield.
Believe me, Wigfield's not the worst of the 90s, God almighty. Don't get me started on the 90s. No, don't actually, because I don't want to get distracted. I've got three stories I wanted to bring up, and 25 minutes to do it. So you do not distract me with my hatred of the 90s. Okay. The TUC have also been involved in a new survey that has found parents are facing a huge challenge with holiday clubs cancelled and annual leave used up this coming summer. The poll in question found nearly two-thirds of working mothers do not have enough childcare for the upcoming school holidays. This is a crisis that is deepening. The survey found that nearly half, 48% of mothers, said they were managing caring responsibilities through some form of flexible working, with around 2 in 5 combining work from home with childcare. 1 in 8 said they would have to reduce their hours, and the same proportion planned to take unpaid leave. And this was also worsened by 1 in 5 having used all of their annual leave allowance on homeschooling during the lockdowns that we've had over the last year. Again, TUC's General Secretary, Francis O'Grady, said, "If ministers don't act, we risk turning the clock back on generations of progress women have made at work." Ofsted statistics published in May showed that more than 2,600 early years providers closed between April 2020 and the end of March 2021. Including 442 nurseries and 2,185 childminders. That was printed in the Guardian recently. TUC and Mother Pucker, that's P-U-K-K-A, have started a petition calling for 10 days paid carers leave for all parents and call for a legal right to flexible work from their first day of employment, along with major investment in childcare. That is what progressive actions look like, folks. Here is a problem. Let's try and deal with it. By the way, I will send Dave a link to that petition at the end of the show, so we'll put it in the show description. Next up, a jaw-dropping fall in life expectancy in Britain. So, a report by Sir Michael Marmot, released at the end of June, has found declining life expectancy and deteriorating social conditions in the poorest areas here in Britain. This has been specifically in Greater Manchester in the COVID-19 figures, is where they spotted such a graphic downturn. Marmot's report revealed that coronavirus death rates in Greater Manchester are 25% higher than the England average during the year to March, leading to, in the words of the report, a jaw-dropping fall in life expectancy and widening social and health inequalities across the region over the past year. This all exists within the context of the government claims to be trying to level up across the country, as we sort of talked about earlier on. The Prime Minister likes to claim that he will reward the North, especially those who have betrayed their communities, by voting for him. It also seems less a case of spending the money that should be spent, which the country has plenty of, rather than the government taking from one poor area or group and putting that money into the minimal amount of social welfare they can imagine while relying on the volunteer sector and the uncredited labour that goes on to take care of the rest. These deteriorating health inequalities in this region and across similarly deprived areas of the country are shown in the report as a result of long-standing avoidable socio-economic inequalities and ethnic disadvantages that have been exacerbated by a decade of spending cuts, then amplified by the COVID-19 disaster and the lockdown effects. To his credit, Marmot has not just been critical, but also proposed a plan for government investment in jobs, housing, education and local services to tackle long-standing health and social inequalities. He suggests a wider focus on addressing the social conditions that cause inequality at community level. Less overt focus on large economic infrastructure projects that government has put forward so far, more focus on the local and specific. So this is what all of the white privilege and the flag bullshit is really about. It's about distracting from the inarguable fact that all of our lives are getting much worse. Despite this being a team I have some support for in their political lives, I still hope that England carry on doing their usual trick of failing to win a football tournament. No offence to them, no offence to the players, but frankly, living in this country will be utterly unbearable when they win anything, and it could be genuinely dangerous for this to happen because people seem to care little enough already about real life activities and consequences. So it can only get worse if the team actually won anything. Then they just basically have a license to disengage entirely. I'd prefer right now that they stick to being the proactive opposition to government that we all wish the Labour Party were being. So good on you, Marcus. Keep it going. None of these conditions we have discussed here, and there are plenty more, will ever be addressed by sitting back and allowing the present system to carry on unchanged and unchallenged. It must be changed, and that will not happen with this grossly corrupt government and their unaccountable capitalism that runs rampant, and that we waste time thinking about football games and whether or not being on your knees is a good thing. It just must be addressed, folks. If there's nothing else you hear from me, it simply must be addressed. Please hear that. Now, one more thing. Taking in the homeless is something else that I found something out this week that took me back a little bit. So one aspect of the pandemic that seemed quite positive on the surface was getting the homeless people off the streets and into safer places like hotels that weren't being used throughout the 2020 and 2021 period because of the lockdowns. This was a government of careless bastards who hate poor people being forced to deal with homelessness that they had ignored or used to their advantage for years and years. And that includes all the people we mentioned earlier. While it was the right thing to force them to do this, it seems to have not been as simple as merely getting the vulnerable off the streets as part of the Everyone In initiative, as it was called. The Museum of Homelessness keeps accounts of those who die on the streets in order to pay tribute to people forgotten by wider society, but also to hold decision makers to account through their Dying Homeless project. They found deaths had risen drastically by 37% since March 2020 across the UK. Almost all these deaths happened when people were indoors rather than out on the street. The Museum of Homelessness notes that, of course, just putting people indoors somewhere without support or community backing does not end their homelessness. There was no attempt to measure the quality of the experience for those concerned, and politicians have ignored all of these facts, and sadly, the pathetically compliant British media have done exactly the same. The government even announced at one point that rough sleeping numbers had dropped by 37%. Well, yeah, you could put it that way, I suppose. Now, we can say that the Everyone In campaign saved people concerned from COVID-19 on the whole, but it did not save their lives. And again, this appears to be because the process was rushed into without any regard for properly solving homelessness. Again, what I think is that when you have, it's a good example of this, when you have a governing body like the one we have and a governing economic order like the one we have that does not care about its victims, it's actually quite happy to create them because they see it as one of the benefits. It's great that we managed to force them to take it seriously. But again, this is what happens when they enter into something they don't really have any belief in, they don't really have any care in, they couldn't care less about. The problem with that, you know, the downside, the major downside, is that they just simply kind of go, oh, well, fine, then just do whatever, you know, just do whatever. And they don't actually put the proper care structure in place because they don't care. This is actually something that runs through pretty much all the stories we talked to about tonight, about key workers, kids in poverty, about school and after school places shutting down because working mothers not being able to afford to get their kids somewhere to work and to play while they're working, all that kind of stuff. This is the result. Anyway, it was found, for instance, that during the Everybody In campaign, or initiative, whatever the hell you want to call it, that far more people than thought were affected by homelessness, for instance. Anything above the basic roof over your head was left to volunteer groups again, like the Museum of Homelessness, the Outside Project, and Streets Kitchens, among other. These fine groups had to get not only info about COVID-19 to those suffering destitution, but also inform them that what the new laws meant when they were rushed through to deal with lockdown enforcement, because this was one of the reasons why it has so much harassment of rough sleepers and others from law enforcement. Again, they were harassing them for sleeping in the streets. Well, what other options do they have? Combine this with how illegal and undocumented immigrants are still scared of legal repercussions, also known as a hostile environment, if they show up at health centres to get the vaccine, and we're seeing how the inhumane treatment of people based on cultural ideas of acceptability and citizenship, that is the UK asylum and immigration systems, is putting everybody in graver danger, just so you can feel good about being cruel to Johnny Foreigner, then go and watch 40 Towers again. This is the actual reality of that sort of thing. If you treat people like this, if you shit all over people and say they don't belong here and so they don't have rights to access healthcare, it makes everything more dangerous for all of us. Why are you so stupid that you can't understand that? Yeah, one more story, Dave, but do you want to feedback on some of that before I do?
No, John, you do exceptional work for the homeless. Even before the pandemic, I think you attended many events and interviewed so many people on this terrible, horrible, growing, and it is growing, whatever you want to call it. It's not a nice thing for us to be proud of. John?
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly my point. You know, from getting drunk and pissing in the streets to screaming blue murder when, you know, a boat full of people come across the channel who are in desperate need. If you really love the country, if you really care about it, you need to put that in action. And the fact is, folks, you don't. Okay? I mean, to be honest, the kind of people I'm talking about here are probably not likely to listen to this show, unless they hate listening. And that's fine with me because it drives our numbers up. But I think that, you know, the results here are we are all in a worse situation. And more importantly, none of you are in a better situation. None of you have better lives for behaving this way, for treating people this way. What do you get out of it? You just get some meaningless sadistic pleasure like the Home Secretary does. You know, it's just savagery for the sake of it. What's the point? What's the fucking point? Really. Anyway, last big story this week, and then we can just have a chat for whatever's left. Afghanistan. So recently we've seen the supposed final withdrawal of US and British troops from Afghanistan after a 20-year conflict. While we now get the usual attempts to paint this retreat in a positive light, it is somehow possible to proclaim that this is a victorious activity in some way. The mighty empires of America and their junior partner are doing a good thing. 20 years ago when they marched into another piss-poor country full of bravado about the new age of global dominance for our way of life and all of that stuff that so many of you have forgotten throughout the early parts of the 2000s. Mainly because the early 2000s were kind of just the same as the 90s and everybody was switched off. Anyway, now with the recent, with the retreat finally done and only the pitiful remnants of the leftovers of that age either proclaiming some kind of victory or equally claiming that the country will be worse off now the soldiers have left, blah, 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 we finally see the bitter end of that totally worthless era. The dead are almost too large to count. The supposed enemy, depending on which week it is, are still there. And the war on terror, whatever that was, is almost forgotten about. I have nothing to really say about it other than that, to be honest. Boris Johnson tells the weakened British public that this is another disaster that we can be proud of being involved in. But I really, for the life of me, cannot see how. The population, those that we did not murder, are no better off. And those that might have seen any bare increased standard of living live in a constant fear because of it now. Government services are weak and cannot deliver over in Afghanistan. Infrastructure is broken, probably beyond repair. So maybe Britain and America did succeed there by bringing what we live through to the good people of Afghanistan. You've now got the same system we've got. Congratulations. One estimate of dead in the country puts it at 50,000, which is likely to be a big understatement. Another says double that, about 100,000. Both are less than Johnson and his crew have managed to kill here with their negligence and carelessness throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. So, and not to mention also before that with austerity that was started by David Cameron and ran through Theresa May, if anyone remembers her. So maybe the Afghans got off lightly, all in all. Violence against women remains a serious problem, even with more of them in parliament. No one in Afghanistan has really benefited at all, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have made the world a substantially more dangerous place for everybody. More terrorism, more instability, greater poverty, and larger amounts of death. But what this should also stand as an example of to this part of the world, as we get poorer and more desperate, and eventually our leaders will need to start another war to distract us, is how two of the most overspent armed forces in the world totally failed to win against forces substantially less funded than them. They go, do not involve yourselves in a civil war, folks, because you will always lose if you're not part of the place that's having the civil war. With all of the drones, the counterinsurgency, the blanket bombing, the torture, the troops on the ground, they could not win in 20 years. And as all wars of this century and many before it show, America cannot win wars. This is a failing empire, and the only benefit Britain has on them is that their empire failed years ago. We do very, very well to not actually associate ourselves as closely anymore, because we never should have in the first place. But that's a really good example. So I suppose in closing, before me and Dave just chat about these things, I suppose, I was thinking about this earlier in the week, right? And for the longest time, people I know, people around me, sometimes jokingly, sometimes seriously, have always told me, you know, you're too serious. You take everything too seriously. You need to relax. You need to switch off sometimes. You know. Now, if you ask my doctor or my psychiatrist, they might tell you there's something in that. But what I see, what I've seen a lot, especially during my adult years, is people so switched off that they have an inability to switch back on. I really feel like we're not actually involved in our own lives anymore. And I understand why, to some degree. I understand the political campaign from the 80s onwards to disempower working people, to disempower the working class specifically, in order to prevent us from achieving anything, in order to prevent us from getting into the halls of power again, actually in order to try and prevent us from getting into the halls of culture as well. And we've seen the result of that, which is that culture isn't worth a shit, and it's completely impossible to create anything original, unique or interesting anymore, it seems. Maybe not impossible, but it certainly seems that way. And I would defend my way of life, despite the amount of stress that it's caused and the amount of non-enjoyment it's had and the amount of relationships it's ruined, because to be switched off now, it seems like this is the result now. You know, everything is absolutely going to hell. We're boiling up, where people don't have places to live. And still, you want to celebrate nightclubs opening in the middle of a horrendous pandemic. I'm kind of a little bit lost for words. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I need to think about that, and maybe I'll come back a bit in another show. But what's your feedback on all this stuff?
Well, I'd just like to say, for those that say John Babb's very serious, I know John Babb quite personally, and we actually spend more time laughing than talking about serious stuff. And secondly, about the issues that John talks about, good, bad, or indifferent. If you don't have opposition to the status quo, you'll have things go crazy. In Parliament, you have opposition. You have people pressing their MPs to raise things. It's called opposition. You need opposition to things. So it's many things that have been, whoever the party is, that have been put forward. Of course, you need a majority. But you need a majority from your MP whose constituents agree with you. So the MP may say, yeah, absolutely, yeah, the head of the party says I've got to vote this way. Well, hang on a minute. My constituents say otherwise. And John could be an opposition and write to his MP and say, look, I don't agree with what the leader of that party is saying, and could you raise this issue? And you've also got things, something Tony Blair brought in, actually. One is the Freedom of Information Act 2004, where you're able to get information released on issues that may affect you at work. So the employer has to supply you with that information legally. And one is online petitions. If you reach 100,000, it gets a hearing in the House of Commons, which has become more and more popular. And as I mentioned on John's show before, there are now groups infiltrating these other groups when they create petitions to homeless, jobs, poverty, affordable housing, greener ideas. Very rich companies are creating these groups and infiltrating these other groups and trying to dampen it down. That's how opposition works nowadays in the 21st century. Without opposition, it would just run amok. And in regards to Afghanistan, I think the day of this country invading other countries are going or gone. I don't think it will be unanimous anymore. I think we've learned the lessons, and as I said, the technology and the internet now, where people are sharing information and getting a consensus, is changing the dimensions on how we think and what we do and how things are done traditionally. So no, I don't think John's miserable. I think John is one of the people in our society that create opposition for whoever the party is from running amok for the interests of themselves. John?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, but it's too much about me. That wasn't the point, but no, do you know what I mean? I feel like the disconnect is, we could easily do a whole show or more about this, because when you talk about this kind of disconnection, you're talking about mental health issues, you're talking about social issues, you're talking about concepts of alienation, or even when you do feel connected. And again, this is, I come back to the point where we started this evening, you know, the way that everyone tries to drum up, the way the media or those in them try to drum up a sense of belonging to something, and it's usually on a sporting event, football being the main one. It's just been decided at some committee meeting that none of us were invited to, that apparently football is going to be very, very important for the entire country, and we're all supposed to care about it. And there's so much to say within that. I mean, personally, I think the people doing that have no time for them, because I think they're just cynics, and they're doing it, as I said before, to distract from what they're really up to. You know, passing truly awful bills that actually limit, for instance, our right to protest and things like that, which is not the aspect of, you know, if they were doing that in Litvinenko's country, if they were, if someone did that in China, or God forbid, if somebody did that in Cuba, you know, we would be rattling out think piece after think piece about how this is dictatorship, this is how democracy dies. You know, but well, it's dying in Britain, okay? It's dying right before your eyes, and you're too busy wanting the pub to open so that you can get pissed and disconnect from all the horror of life. Well, you have my sympathies, folks, but it's not good enough. You need to, you know, come on.
No, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong in going to the pub. I have no problem with that. So this is one of those situations where me and John laugh. See, we laugh more than we talk serious. Actually,
it's you trying to stop me from alienating what little audience we have left. Okay, don't slag off from going to the pub. Don't slag off the football, for God's sake.
But it's interesting about the general public. It's a funny one, because after World War II, general election, country was poor, broke. You know, and Winston Churchill said, "Yep, I'm going to the country," and he lost.
Yep.
So it's a bizarre. Nothing's given, but obviously he had lots of opposition even from his own party, because there wasn't a National Health Service then. People were skint, the country was skint, and they wanted something done about it. So he went to the country, and this is when voting was extremely popular. It was a big day out for people to go and vote. It was your one-in-lifetime chance every 4 years to go and choose the government. And people at that time thought, I know kids are laughing when I say that now, but at that time, and they decided, no, we've had enough of you. Apparently, one of the consensus was you talk too much. So it's a funny one. You know, don't this. Although, as I said, the social media is the new media, and people are debating wrongly or rightly on there, and just watch your backs. Politicians need to listen, this is the 21st century, it's happening. And in 9 years' time, the political landscape of this country will change. John?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good points there, and we need to demand political leadership, and there are certain ways of doing it. I mean, interestingly, like earlier on, you referred to writing to my MP. My MP's Boris Johnson. I haven't bothered writing to him for years because it's a total waste of time. But that's because in his ruling class position and with the media on his side, he's able to get away with things like that. But also, just quickly on, because you brought up a very interesting subject that I like to delve into, which is during the war, this period of history that everyone's obsessed with and yet no one seems to know anything about. The country did not unite wholeheartedly throughout that time. Everybody knew who was who. Everyone knew what the ruling class was like. And there were loads and loads of strikes during that period. Working class power and solidarity was very, very strong at that time. And that's why it wasn't just like the war ended and they all suddenly looked at Churchill and went, nah. You know, they knew who he was from the off. They used to talk about him at the time. And then when he came in and said, yeah, thanks for doing it, similar kind of thing to now, you know, thanks for being key workers and saving all of our lives in the last year. By the way, here's a 1% pay rise, which works out a pay cut when you adjust it to inflation. He came out and said, yes, thanks for the war, thanks for the dying and shit like that. But, you know, we're just going to keep everything exactly the same. And for whatever, I don't want to kind of over romanticise this time. But, you know, most people just went, no, that's not good enough, mate. Piss off. We want a welfare state. So, you know, there is that aspect of it. But again, let's not live in the past. You know, learn from the past, but we need to take these things forward. And now more than ever, you know, it is absolutely vital. So, yeah, please do, you know, just, you can switch off, but for God's sake, switch on first. That's the most important thing.
John, many thanks, and we'll catch up next week.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.